This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We have a chance to talk more about the city of Valparaiso now with the man who is in charge. Matt Murphy was elected as mayor of the city of Valparaiso in the general election, and he has had now going on close to the third month of being mayor at City Hall, and we're glad to have him with us on the program today. Mr. Mayor, thank you, and welcome to Regionally Speaking.
Well, thank you, Chris. Really glad to be on this morning with you, and I look forward to filling you in with what we've been up to the past 2 months.
Well, you've been a busy guy, to be sure, but that was what you promised, I know, and at least in responding to the letter that you said you got on the desk here from Mayor John Costas as he finished up after the election last November. He had promised, and I thought it was interesting, that the note that he mentioned that said that mayors are not elected simply to occupy an office, make speeches, and kiss babies. Well, we're hoping you're not kissing babies, because you probably get a lot of complaints and worse about that. But certainly, for sure, sitting in the office and making speeches is not really a big part of the mayor's job. Getting the team together and taking action and keeping the city together, I guess, is the most important thing, isn't it?
Yeah, we're working hard. We're eager to engage citizens from all interests right now. We're committed to representing all parts of our community, those that supported us and those that challenged us, and everyone matters here. And so what we're trying to communicate early on is that we're listening, and we're ready to get to work.
And about the end of January, you had your first State of the City address to folks that came and listened, supporters, and I'm sure challengers as well, too, folks who didn't vote for you in November. But the idea was that you wanted to inform the city on, first off, what you've been doing, certainly in that first month of office, but also what is lying ahead in 2020 and beyond. You had a number of things that you brought up. I've got my notes here from what you had to say. Let's hit some of the high points here. We've got time to be able to cover some of the important things that have happened, certainly, and you're taking care of in the city of Valparaiso. One of them is, to start with, is the park system. Where do we stand on that, and what are you hoping to do here this year?
Well, one of the things that sets Valparaiso apart from the rest of Northwest Indiana is our excellent park system, which is celebrating 75 years this year. We've grown from a single park to about 20 parks, and we also consider our pathways part of our parks, and we've added 2 miles of pathways to the city of Valparaiso, bringing the total to about 22 miles of pathways, and they're just very popular features in our city. In addition to that, we've also seen the grand opening of our new horticulture center, and adjacent to that, we're really excited we're almost near the opening of a much-awaited dog park.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's going to be a nice amenity for the dog lovers in Valparaiso. And beyond that, we've made upgrades to Bicentennial Park, Creekside, and others. And the big thing for parks in 2020 is that we will be updating our master plan. And so we're kicking that process off, and that process will be led by our parks director, John Seibert. So would we encourage the citizens of Valparaiso to get engaged in that, and we need to hear from you as we develop our parks, update our parks master plan.
Now, one of the areas that is very seldom seen because it's underground but is very important is the city utilities, and I know the city of Valparaiso in particular has a lot to be proud of. What did you find when you were taking office that you liked and didn't like and you'd like to make improvements on?
Well, our city utility is absolutely one of our biggest assets in our community. We have such a great team over there led by Utility Director Steve Poulos. We have over 13,000 accounts. We have more than 500 miles of water, sewer, and stormwater pipes underground. And last year, we provided over 1.6 billion gallons of water to Valpo customers. And recently, we acquired the neighboring Damon Run utility, which expands our service territory and creates economies of scale for the Damon Run ratepayers. And it's really a huge driver of our economic development efforts, and I couldn't be more proud of the work they're doing and the board of directors over there.
I know one of the things that folks in Valparaiso are most proud about are streets and sidewalks and the like, and always have kept up, or if they need to be kept up, they're certainly attended to. What's the latest from Public Works, and what do you look forward to as we get 2020 underway?
Sure. Well, yeah, Public Works, they do a fantastic job as well. And last year they were They were busy paving a record amount. We paved almost 10 miles of our city streets. They repaired or installed a mile and a half of new sidewalks and pathways. They picked up about 2,500 tons of recycling. And so they've just been tremendous. And we've got a great team at Public Works, and it's absolutely critical service they provide to our residents. And they've been led by Nate McGinley. Nate is moving on to a project management role this year. Mm-hmm. Stay tuned for new leadership at Public Works.
I think certainly going along with not only keeping the streets up, include keeping up all the roundabouts. And I'm determined that the city of Valparaiso is in very serious competition with the city of Carmel as to who can have, as to who can have the most roundabouts, or how you can fit them in and make it easier, maybe for some more difficult to drive around Valparaiso. But that's a very important part, and engineering is of course part of that too. And in fact, you've got one big project for a roundabout coming up this year, don't you?
Yeah, our engineering team has done a great job. We just opened up the new Sylhavie LaPorte roundabout, which is now efficiently moving about 35,000 vehicles daily. It's working magnificently. And you mentioned another project we're keeping our eye on is we're optimistic that funding will be in place for a new roundabout at the intersection of Campbell and Lincoln Way, and that's mm-hmm. that's been a kind of a dangerous intersection. It's a little offset. It's very busy, and it would be a nice a roundabout would be a nice addition there to make it more safe.
I know Lincoln Way is one of the gateways to the city of Valparaiso, and it's not the heaviest travel, but it is pretty busily traveled. I mean, US 30 has got to be probably the heaviest travel getting into downtown Valparaiso for sure, and along the edge of the city, but Lincoln Way is very important because it leads right into downtown Valparaiso.
Yeah, Chris, Lincoln Way is our main street, and it is an important street. And we took it over from the state about 5 years ago, and we did a program with them. That's how we were able to beautify Route 30, which we're still working on. That's about a 5-year process. We have more projects coming next year, and I want to let everybody know that NDOT will be resurfacing Route 30 next year from the airport all the way down to Hayes Leonard School. So it's going to be another busy paving season down to one lane, but it's important work, and we're happy to get the paving done for sure.
We're talking with Valparaiso Mayor Matt Murphy about what has been happening in the city and what's coming up here in 2020. Economic development is very important too, and Patrick Lipp's been the guy who's been in charge of that for a number of years. What does Patrick and his team over in economic development have planned for the city of Valparaiso this year?
Yeah, so the economic development is sort of changing. That was a role that I served under Mayor Costas, and Patrick is, we're going to utilize Patrick now as our city attorney, general counsel, and he's got extensive knowledge, and we're really excited to bring him over into City Hall and keep us out of trouble. Mm-hmm. The economic development position will really be led by our new redevelopment director, Brandon Dickinson, and Brandon is an impressive addition to our team. He was the director of economic development for the city of Fishers, where he was very active and key in bringing in a ton of investment and a lot of jobs. And so we're really excited to have Brandon on board and look forward to his leadership.
I know that part of the work that the city of Valparaiso does is to not only move people around in their vehicles, that's the streets and the roundabouts job, but also mass transit is very important, too. How do things stand as far as the Valparaiso transit system is concerned going this year?
Yeah, our transit system is strong and growing. We've added a fifth route to the Chicago Dash Express bus to Chicago, plus a new South Shore Connect bus service to the South Shore train. All of our transit services are growing, adding riders each year, and we also now have the Royal Excursions got a new, it's called the Zoom service, that's going to be beginning here in a few weeks, that will run daily trips up to Midway and O'Hare from mm-hmm. our transit-oriented development. And in conjunction with that, obviously we've got the old ANCO site there that is hopefully going to be, it's looking very positive that the Journeyman Distillery will go in, and we're real close to inking a deal with those folks, and really excited about what that's going to do to that area and really to the city. It's going to be a tremendous tourism boost to Valparaiso.
How much does the overall Envision Valparaiso 2030 plan fit into the economic development for the city?
Well, it's key. You know, one of the things we're working on right now is as we get fully staffed up here, it's really the next to-do priority list for us is creating a strategic plan out for 5 years. So we've got some work to do just in the next, you know, in the short term, which really 4 to 5 years, that we're going to be focusing on and to blend that into the 2030 plan.
We got a chance in recent weeks to talk with Maggie Clifton, who is the Community Engagement Director for the City of Valparaiso, about various projects and in turn making improvements into downtown Valparaiso. How does Maggie and her team fit in with what Tina St. Alban, who's over in the Valpo Events Program, is doing in getting residents involved in the community and getting them aware of what's actually happening?
Community engagement is our newest department, but it is very visible, as you said. And in just a couple of years, Maggie has managed to create a city government academy and graduate 50 Valparaiso citizens from that. She's also worked to create a neighborhood grant program, and we've awarded 22 grants so far, about $235,000 in improvements to neighborhoods citywide, unifying neighbors, enhancing quality of life, and she's just doing a fantastic job. And then, yes, Tina St. Alban has been leading our Valparaiso events. That continues to do a great job to wow our community and visitors with great experiences. They host about 12 unique events a year and have attracted over 120,000 attendees to the city of Valparaiso. Tina's doing a great job.
That's great. One of the things I know that you mentioned in your State of the City address to residents back in January, with looking ahead for the future, were some things that you wanted to do for neighborhood improvements and the like. Are there any blighted areas that you've had concern about all the time, may have brought up during the campaign for mayor, that you now as the mayor have a chance to be able to put into place?
Yeah, you know, that's our building department is in charge of managing that unsafe buildings and blight. And as any city in Northwest Indiana, we have our fair share of that, and we're trying to be aggressive in dealing with that, following all the rules and regulations set forth by the legislature. And so we do have some areas of town that need some investment. One of the pilot ideas we had last year in the Redevelopment Commission was the transformation of a property at 603 Indiana. If you get a chance, drive by and see. It's a beautiful little custom-built bungalow, mm-hmm. Built by Charleston Builders. Basically, the city bought the property, raised the structure, put out a request for proposal, and got the city involved with helping them come up with a home design that would fit the nature of the neighborhood, and it's just a nice custom home there, and we've got a couple moved in from Minnesota. They're Valpo grads. They wanted to come back to the area, and they wanted to be between the downtown and the university, and so College Hill fits that, and I think there's a lot of opportunity in the College Hill area for investment.
I know that's another area I wanted to at least find out the latest about, is about the relationship that the city of Valparaiso has with Valparaiso University, the so-called town and gown. Since you've worked for the city before becoming mayor, you know the very situation very well. How are things standing right now with President Heckler and the faculty and staff at Valpo, and how are they fitting in with the city these days? And do both of you have any ideas that you're working together on?
Sure, Christy. You know, the university is it's our biggest asset. So working together with them closely is critical. And we've already had one town and gown meeting so far. And really, the big news there, you know, is that President Heckler has announced that he's stepping down, mm-hmm. and the university board of directors has embarked upon a search for the next president of the university. And so, as we shared with them at town and gown, that is just an absolutely critical a leadership position for not only Valparaiso but Northwest Indiana. So we are anxious to see who will be leading that institution in the coming years and get off on the right foot with that individual. And we're really excited about the future of the university and want to work together with them in any way possible to assist them and move them forward, because they really bring a lot to the table for us. They make our community very strong, add a lot of cultural and athletic events. It's so wonderful to have Division I men's basketball in our backyard. A lot of communities don't have that. It's just really a treat, all the plays and the concerts that they provide, and the programs for seniors. The Volts program is very popular. I'll be giving the State of the City to the Volts group here in March. That's a very well-attended group of engaged citizens that the university facilitates. So just an amazing institution. We want to see them succeed and grow and help them any way we can.
Well, Mayor Murphy, in closing of our conversation today, what in a nutshell would you see not only as what you've been able to accomplish here in just a few months as mayor, and what you're looking for certainly for the rest of this year and into the rest of the term?
Sure. The most important things we've been doing is building our team. And, you know, I think I mentioned in the State of the City that having worked for Mayor Costas, I was a sort of a disciple of the believing in the message of the book Good to Great by Jim Collins, and that's making sure you have the right people on the bus in the right seats before you even begin to decide where you're going. And so we feel really good about the folks that we've brought on. A lot of, you know, we've got continuity, we've got some people that have been here and some people had planned to leave, and we've just added some tremendous talent here. I mentioned Brandon Dickinson from Fishers. Beth Schrader will be our new planning director and transit director. She is currently working over in LaPorte for Mayor Dermody, but decided this was an opportunity she wanted to tackle. She's phenomenal. We've added Mike Jabo to be our director of engineering. Mike brings a ton of experience and to our team, and just right away walks into a senior role and is a great leader. So those are just some of the folks that Mike Jessen, who is I announced early on, is our a city administrator who. Is replacing Bill Oding. Bill's retiring, and Bill, if you didn't hear, was just awarded the Distinguished Hoosier Award by Governor Holcomb on February 17th. We had a nice ceremony for him. Bill's retiring, but Mike brings more than 28 years of experience in both corporate and community leadership to the city. He led all these tri-state division right here in Valpo. He's been active in the community. He served on the county council. He's a team builder, and he's a great collaborator and brings a lot of leadership. So the biggest thing we've worked on, Chris, is people and getting that team built out. And that's really what the lion's share of our time has been spent on thus far.
Well, Mr. Mayor, thank you for spending time with us here. We've gone through a lot in our conversation today and hope we have many more in the months and years ahead. And we appreciate you spending time here on Lakeshore Public Radio today.
Absolutely. Happy to do that, Chris. Have a great day.
Thank you. That's Valparaiso Mayor Matt Murphy.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. With an encore edition of Green Fleet Radio from last November, here's Carl Lissick.
Ms. Jennifer Sanders, Public Information Manager for Clean Air Car Check. Jennifer, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Carl.
Jennifer, obviously we know you very well as a board member of South Shore Clean Cities, and we thank you for that. Our listeners likely all know Clean Air Car Check, but maybe not by name. So tell us what Clean Air Car Check is and what do you do?
Well, Clean Air Car Check is the state's vehicle emissions testing program. We actually conduct emissions tests on gasoline-powered passenger vehicles and light-duty trucks that are registered here in Lake and Porter counties. We have 7 stations. Many of you have probably visited us in Hammond, Griffith, Hobart, Crown Point, Valparaiso, Gary, and Portage.
So a lot of people think that their individual vehicles' emissions don't matter in the grand scheme of things, or that their small vehicle doesn't make enough impact compared to larger vehicles like semis. That's not true, though, is it?
The truth is that we all contribute to ground-level ozone. When our personal vehicles, the ones that we drive to work or take our kids to football practice in or do our errands in, aren't running well, those higher levels of exhaust emissions have a direct impact on the air quality of our neighborhoods. As we know through our work with South Shore Clean Cities, many trucking fleets have begun to shift toward greener technologies. That means their trucks are running cleaner and have less negative impact on the overall air quality. That doesn't, I understand, address that many trucks traveling through our high-volume transportation corridors like I-65 and 8094. But those trucks are transient, so those emissions are, those vehicles are passing through. Whereas our vehicles, the ones that we're driving in our neighborhoods to work, to church, to the grocery store, those emissions are in our neighborhoods and they're staying in our neighborhoods. So we do really have a greater overall impact on our local air quality with our own personal vehicles.
What help is available for a motorist who is having trouble getting their vehicle to pass the emission tests?
So Clean Air Car Check has actually been very progressive in providing motorists technical assistance when it comes to diagnosing emissions problems. Our technical repair advice program has become a model for similar programs in other emissions testing states. On staff, we have a diagnostic technician who has more than 20 years experience in the field. His role with the program is simply to assist motorists with all levels of expertise. So he can help provide diagnostic support and guidance to a vehicle owner that has limited automotive experience if that person is trying to attempt to repair their vehicle on their own. And at the other end of the spectrum, he can work directly with repair facilities to help them troubleshoot problem vehicles. He's available for phone consultations 3 days a week, and we also schedule in-person diagnostic appointments with him 2 days a week. At those appointments, he'll actually look at the customer's vehicle, perform diagnostic testing, and leave that customer with written repair advice, telling them what he believes can be done to bring that vehicle into compliance.
So is there assistance available for low-income motorists?
There is. Actually, another innovative program that Indiana has established is the Hardship Repair Grant Program. We have funding available to assist low-income motorists make repairs to their vehicles. Once a vehicle has failed a test, a motorist can call our customer service hotline and apply for this program over the phone. If the financial qualifications are met, we have a process to evaluate the vehicle. We look at things like the value of the vehicle, the cost of repairs, the expected life remaining in the vehicle, and then we provide assistance based on those factors. Some vehicles may pass a less stringent emissions test, some may receive a one-time waiver, and some are repaired using grant funding. No matter the end result, any customer that meets the financial qualifications for our Hardship Repair Grant Program will receive help. All they have to do is call and apply.
That's wonderful. So what are some useful tips for someone preparing to bring their vehicle in for testing?
Look, I understand that no one wants to fail a test of any kind. But I still advise customers who suspect their vehicle may fail to have it tested at Clean Air Car Check prior to making any repairs. For one, our test provides impartial results. As a centralized emissions testing program, all we do is test the vehicles. We aren't trying to sell you repairs. So knowing what is causing an emissions failure prior to taking the vehicle into a repair shop may prevent you from spending money on unnecessary repairs. You may not have to bite on those upsells that the shops are always encouraging.
So do you recommend specific repair shops to work on emissions failures?
We don't recommend specific repair facilities. However, we encourage motorists to consider choosing an Indiana certified emission repair facility. These shops all have at least one technician on staff that has successfully completed a 60-hour training course in emissions diagnostics and repairs. And these shops also are required to have and maintain specific tools and equipment that are essential to proper emissions diagnostics. And no, these shops don't pay to be included on the list, and we don't receive any kind of reward for sending customers to them. We just hope that our customers make informed and educated decisions about the repair facilities they choose.
So how can our listeners learn more about Clean Air Car Check, Jennifer?
Our website is www.cleanaircarcheck.com, and we have a customer service hotline that is answered by real live local operators 6 days a week. So if you have any questions specific to your vehicle or about the program in general, the number to call is 888-240-1684, and we're there Monday through Saturday, 9 to 5.
Great information, Jennifer. Thank you very much. And that will do it for today's edition of Green Fleet Radio. Thank you again to Jennifer Sanders, Public Information Manager for Clean Air Car Check. Green Fleet Radio airs three times each Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy. Thanks, Jennifer.
Thank you.
It's Carl Lissick with his encore conversation with Jennifer Sanders. Green Fleet Radio is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities and the Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission. And you can hear Green Fleet Radio every Wednesday here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. We have with us on Regionally Speaking an update of sorts on the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University, which is still very much underway. Allison Schutte, who along with fellow professor Liz Werfel, are the co-directors of the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. And Allison is with us here to talk about a very special presentation, which is coming up on the IU Northwest campus this evening. And Allison, thank you for joining us on the program today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Take a moment, if you will. Tell us about this link maybe people don't necessarily make between the initiative, which is called Flight Paths, and the Welcome Project itself.
Yeah, the Welcome Project was a project that Liz and I started in 2010. It began as a campus project, but it evolved to include the communities around us and the region. So Flight Paths is actually our initiative that we launched in 2015, which is documenting stories about Northwest Indiana, specifically around Gary at the mid-century and the rise of the civil rights movement and suburbanization, white flight, and deindustrialization in the mills.
One of the interesting things that you note in some of the information that's out there on the Facebook page, talking about presentation coming up this evening, starts out in 1960, 180,000 people lived in Gary, Indiana, a thriving industrial city. 50 years later, only 80,000 people live there. And then the questions, why, what happened, and where did the residents go? And that's all part of Flight Paths, is it not?
Yes, we're actually building an interactive documentary website that we will use to help people explore answers to those questions. There's no simple answers for sure, but there's a number of different factors, circumstances, causes, conditions, policies, and practices that were shaping and informing residents' decisions about which neighborhoods they could live in, move to. And so we're hoping that the putting into this larger historical narrative very one-on-one individual experiences of life in Gary neighborhoods, starting in like the 1950s and going up to today, will really help people explore those questions about the region and how our lives have been reshaped, our neighborhoods have been reshaped, our cities have been reshaped.
When the idea of the separate presentation within the initiative came about, I know a lot of the conversations had kind of come up as part of the Welcome Project in particular. In fact, we've had a chance to be able to show some and offer some of the conversations on Tuesdays here on Regionally Speaking from the project itself with some of the people that either actually lived at the time in Gary or surrounding the community or had some influence upon themselves by the community, by just being residents of the region. So sometimes you learn some of these things by just listening to some of these conversations. That had to be very interesting to be able to sit down across the microphone from some of these people coming in and telling their stories.
Absolutely. My favorite part of the work and the most transformative part of the work has been sitting and listening to people explore what their lives were like in their neighborhoods and with their families and in their community organizations. It's a very rich tapestry, and you realize pretty quickly, especially as you listen to more and more different kinds of stories, how dependent on where you lived is often how you're going to view what happened to the city of Gary.
I know that funding is a big part of this. You can't do these projects and these initiatives without getting some financial help from various organizations. And I think the last time we had an extended conversation was when the word came out that the Welcome Project and getting the Flight Paths Initiative started got the initial support from the National Endowment for the Humanities. But I understand along the way, too, you've gotten some other help from Indiana sources. Tell us about what the National Endowment's been able to help you with on this, as well as what you've gotten from Indiana sources.
The National Endowment for the Humanities has funded us twice. The first time was to build a design document of their website, and the second time was to build the prototype. And along the way, Indiana Arts Commission helped us early on to create an audio documentary, which you can find on our website. And then most recently, Indiana Humanities helped out with an action grant, which also contributed to us being able to complete the prototype of the website, which is what we're actually sharing tonight in the presentation. We're going to walk people through the prototype of the website so they can see where we're headed.
Mm-hmm. That's got to be interesting to be able to show that up as a some kind of presentation on the off the computer onto the screen in front of people, to actually get to see something that maybe they've talked about or you've talked with them about, but they actually get to see what you're putting together and how things are working so far.
Yeah, I mean, it's exciting to have gotten to this point. It took a while. And so to be able to have a vision of the final product is really exciting. And to see how the individual storytellers from the people we've interviewed in the region, how that sits next to stories about like important landmark institutions in a neighborhood or these practices and policies that were shaping people's decision-making, I think it's a pretty dynamic site. And so tonight what we're hoping to do is turn it into a conversation so that people have a sense of what it would be like to be on their own on the website. But in this case, tonight we also get to talk with other participants about what we see and what we're learning.
I understand, too, that the opportunity this evening is to be able to offer up a visual tour of the Tolleston neighborhood. That is first, what is the Tolleston neighborhood, and how does this fit in with the Flight Paths Initiative?
Yeah, for the prototype, we needed to produce a concept of what the actual full website would look like. So we decided to concentrate on one neighborhood, mm-hmm. and Tolleston is a neighborhood that predates Gary and was incorporated early on. And happens to be a place where we have already done a lot of work with interviewing people. It was a natural neighborhood for us to choose in terms of embedding our storytellers alongside of our understanding of the history of the neighborhood, which Jim Lane created for us. And one of the churches there, St. John's Lutheran Church, is one of the oldest churches in Gary and also predates the city itself.
It sounds like that you've gotten a lot of help from Jim, who's a historian that's based at IU Northwest. And so he's been of great help in getting some of these historical landmarks down to you and make them available to be able to put into the system.
Absolutely. The Indiana University Northwest Archives have been instrumental. Both Jim and Steve McShane there have been very supportive and pointed us in directions of research and people to talk to. We have a whole team of fellow scholars and documentarians and community activists who really made sure that we're talking to the right people and filling out gaps in our stories. We definitely have never done this alone. Mm-hmm. It's a team project for sure.
It's too big a task to be able to handle one or two people, to be sure.
That's right.
Or even a group of students that might be helping out from Valparaiso University, to be sure. Now, this evening's presentation, which is entitled Flight Paths, Mapping Our Changing Neighborhood, is going to be this evening, starting in, I guess, around 6 o'clock, and it'll be at the Anderson Library and Conference Center on the IU Northwest campus in Gary. What's the situation for parking? That people want to come over and take a look and get participate in this event tonight?
We are partnering with the Center for Urban and Regional Excellence, and they have made sure that people will be able to park for free from 5:30 tonight till 8 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a nice way of helping people make sure that they can attend and not feel like there's fees that will get in the way.
Now, since you and Liz Werfel have been working on this project since the inception, starting, as we mentioned earlier in the conversation, with the Welcome Project per se, and then branching off into the Flight Paths Initiative, how do you feel being at this particular point, and what is now ahead that we can look forward to find out more about how Flight Paths is evolving?
Yeah, well, like I said, it feels pretty amazing to have a prototype finally after 5 years of work and see that the direction we've been headed is something that people have responded to strongly. We've tested it out with a number of people, and tonight will be another way of gauging people's response to the website. Our next stage is to put in grants for more funding. We're doing another NEH grant for production. We've put in with the American Learned Council Societies for a digital extension grant. If we receive that, We can support 8 different scholars, some of them community scholars, who will each be assigned a neighborhood or a city in the region in order to add content to the website like we have in Tolleston. So we'll begin to, really what we have to do is now fill in the map. We have to add content to all the neighborhoods in Gary and some of the surrounding cities.
Allison Schutte is the co-director, along with Liz Werfel, of the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. And we're talking about the presentation, which is involved with the Flight Paths Initiative. That presentation is going to be this evening, beginning about 6 o'clock, and it'll be in room 105 of the Anderson Library and Conference Center on the IU Northwest campus in Gary. There is free parking available in the area between 5:30 and 8:30 in the evening. And if you have an opportunity to go over, check out the presentation, talk with the people, put in your 2 cents worth, and if you are certainly involved personally or family-wise in the flight of residents from Gary into the suburbs, about the changes of the makeup of the demographics, economic and racial, in the city of Gary over the 60s and 70s, they want to know more about it, and we hope that you have a chance to participate. And thank you very much, Allison, for being with us, and hope you have a great crowd over at IU Northwest for the presentation this evening.
Thanks. Appreciate it, Chris.
There's an important collaboration that has just gotten started from Northwest Indiana. The Lake Area United Way is collaborating with Methodist Hospitals, and with the help, some financial help from the organization, which is called Early Learning Indiana, is going to be able to create a collaboration which should address problems with health care here in the region, in particular in the city of Gary. With us to talk more about this collaboration and how it's getting started and what's going to happen eventually, we have the president and CEO of the Lake Area United Way with us, Lisa Daugherty. Lisa, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about the overall transition that the Lake Area United Way has been making in the recent years to try to help Northwest and Indiana, in particular Lake County's low-income families, and in turn how this new collaboration, a very important one, is going to fit in with it.
Chris, in a nutshell, we had announced 5 years ago that we were going to transition to a new model. We went out into the community and we identified a population called ALICE, which stands for Asset Limited, Income Constrained, Employed. These are folks who are working, but they're not earning enough to afford basic necessities. And in Lake County, we've got about 1 in 4 of our families that fall into that situation. You know, what's challenging for folks in that population is that because they're working, they're not eligible for public assistance. So in a lot of ways, they're more vulnerable than our folks in poverty. So, you know, when we identified ALICE, we again went back out into the community, talked to ALICE families, and we heard a few, you know, different themes, barriers that were extremely challenging for them. You know, the fact that they didn't have a safety net. You know, there's not enough housing stock that is affordable. You know, we all know that healthcare is an issue. You know, one area, healthy food is another. And then the two areas where we landed were on helping ALICE families access livable wage jobs and quality child care. Mm-hmm. And so this collaboration with Methodist is a perfect example of the types of new initiatives that we'll be working on, because we sought funding, and with that funding and, of course, the campaign monies that we raise, a small portion of those campaign monies, we are going to be able to put a path to level 3 quality child care center in the Methodist Northlake campus, which happens to sit right in a child care desert in, mm-hmm. in Gary.
I understand from Early Learning Indiana, their information shows on a statewide basis that more than 45% of Hoosier children live in a child care desert. Is that a higher percentage here in particular in Lake County because of our situation here?
Yeah, so the child care deserts are technically by census tract. And so we have three deserts in Gary. There's one in Crown Point. There's one in Whiting and Highland and Schererville. And what they mean by child care deserts technically is that there are a lot of jobs, but there's not enough quality child care seats to provide child care for all the children that reside in that area as well.
It's quite a challenge, it sounds. We have families that certainly could have, I guess, could use the help. And they're looking desperately with decent jobs to be able to find a place to be able to bring the youngsters so they're well cared for while they have their jobs and still can pick them up in the evening.
Yeah, we really see this as a two-generation approach because while, you know, helping families access better-paying jobs is a key focus for us. A lot of the families, you know, if they don't have that quality child care, they often choose to stay at home. So this strategy is going to benefit employers, you know, the parents, and of course, give the children a great start and have them ready for kindergarten when they're experiencing that quality child care.
Tell us a little bit about Tanika Davis. She is listed as the local child care provider that's going to help you all the most in getting this child care center set up at the North Lake campus.
Yeah, when we have a work group that we're facilitating, one around jobs, one around child care. And the conversation that those groups started having was about, you know, looking for a partner that could provide the child care in an existing space and perhaps for an employer who was struggling with, you know, retaining, advancing employees because of child care. And Geminis Corporation participates regularly in that work group. And Tanika Davis, who runs Faith Child Care, was one of the first providers that they recommended consult with. She's got a couple of other child care centers in Gary. She is a wonderful, wonderful woman, very excited about this project. This is a perfect collaboration to illustrate how coming together can make it happen. You know, Methodist isn't in the business of child care, and employers who have looked to provide a child care center on their properties, it's too expensive and it's out of their realm of expertise. Tanika Davis, who has the expertise, doesn't necessarily have the capital to, you know, renovate or put a facility in. So Lake Erie United Way, you know, convenes the partners, comes to the table with the funding. You know, Tanika is able to to get started and actually sustain that child care center for years to come on her own. So we're essentially funding the initial, you know, renovation, perhaps some subsidies for families who might not be able to afford it, and then we're out and moving on to another important project. So it's really an ideal collaboration for us.
Tell us a little about the plans for this year, because I guess the goal is to have the child care center up and running at the North Lake campus by the end of the calendar year. So it sounds
correct.
Like there's a lot of things that have to be done, certainly in the meantime, and you're planning for, a very impressive operation. You want to get several dozen youngsters be able to be situated in there as time goes on this year.
Yeah, well, one of the reasons that the stars aligned on this project is that Methodist had what used to be an adolescent behavioral health unit that was currently not being used for that purpose. And so we already had a wing, so to speak, that had its own entrance. It has lots of rooms already. There's already a security system. There's an outdoor area that can be easily converted to a playground for the children. You know, so the renovation that we have to do really is limited to, you know, a couple of walls have to come down, a couple have to come up. We've got to put a little bit of plumbing in to accommodate the licensing requirements of the state for a pass to quality level 3 center. But because so much of you know, the building already, you know, fits the project, we're going to be able to move pretty quickly.
Now, obviously, childcare involves more than just from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., and there'll be some after-hours care, I'm sure, that'll have to be provided. Does this give an opportunity to be able to allow that because of the setting that you're putting this in?
Absolutely. We actually, you know, we intend, you know, Methodist is a 24-hour operation, and they've got the security there. You know, there is the activity. They've got employees who need to access. We actually, throughout the county, need more 24-hour care providers because mm-hmm. we have a lot of shift work when it comes to manufacturing and healthcare in particular. So, you know, we are gonna get the child care center up and running initially with about 40 seats, and we will continue to expand the hours so that minimally we're an 18-hour provider with the goal of becoming a 24-hour provider when the demand is there.
Lisa, take a minute and talk about how Early Learning Indiana fits into this. They had a competition, I guess, in a way, for organizations around the Hoosier State to be able to apply for the money that's available. I think they have a million-dollar pot, so to speak, that they're working with here to supply organizations like this one going on, this collaboration between Methodist Hospitals and the Lake Area United Way. In conversations with the folks in Indianapolis about this, you obviously had to explain pretty much like the business plan model that you're going to adapt everything to make it work. What were their thoughts about what's been happening up here in the region?
Well, you know, they obviously, you know, they specifically made the dollars available to initiatives that would benefit a child care, you know, a technically child care desert area. So their intention is to make more child care available, whether it's a project like ours, where it's basically a new center in a desert area, or it's an enhancement that expands, you know, more seats. We're really grateful for this opportunity. I mean, this is a sizable grant that we're receiving, and we've had the idea when the grant opportunity came up. We pulled the partners together to talk about, you know, whether this was realistic to do in the allotted time that early learning, you know, afforded. And all the partners agreed that it was a win-win-win. And we had to submit a letter of intent, which basically described kind of broadly, you know, the scope of the project. And that was accepted. They wanted to go further with that application. So then we had to provide more detail on it. And of course, all the partners had to demonstrate their commitment, you know, to making it happen. And here we are. And I think it's one of many, you know, that will come. There are some other partnerships that we're talking about in other parts of the county. And, you know, there's a backup care strategy that we're working on. You know, when a parent is employed and their child is out of school, whether they're sick or it's a vacation opportunity, we don't have backup child care in this community, and we are determined to bring that here, you know, that will benefit families and employers.
Lisa, what kind of impact do you see this happening generationally, on this community, all of the communities, we should say, in Lake County in particular, that will be able to benefit from what is being planned there in Gary?
Well, like I said, I think it's the first. We are so excited because I think it's the first, you know, collaboration that is really going to demonstrate our new work. It is a two-generation approach. You know, the parents are benefiting because they have quality child care. They don't have to worry about whether their child is safe and if they're learning and if they're prepared for school while they work. It'll be easily accessible, you know, for thousands of employees at Methodist alone. And for the child, you know, there's so much research out there that proves that a child is so much more likely to succeed in school and college and career if they are ready for kindergarten. And that requires a curriculum. And you know, we have got to raise awareness around that, too. I don't know that parents in the community really understand the value of that quality curriculum at such an early age. The providers know it. The educators know it. But we have to educate parents and the business community, because not only does it benefit the families, but this is a future workforce. So we are training, workers of the future. So employers need to understand how critical that early learning experience is and how it comes back to them. In their workforce.
Well, Lisa, I'm looking forward to getting more updates as we go on through 2020 on this project, and congratulations to the Lake Area United Way, as well as to Methodist Hospitals, for getting into this collaboration with the help of Early Learning Indiana. And thank you for spending time with us to explain what this is all about and what kind of benefits and great opportunities this will give for everyone who would take advantage of it here in the region. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Lisa Dodgy is the president and CEO of the Lake Area United Way. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. And I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. Coming up tomorrow on our program, we have Meredith Colias-Pete with the Post Tribune on the stories that she's covered. And we also bring back Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson's conversation with Dr. David Hill, who is representing the American Lung Association, about what the advocacy group is doing on behalf of people trying to quit smoking, and in particular, vaping. We hope you'll join us on tomorrow's program for that.